And to hear real physicists discuss real physical questions is always a pleasure. I'm going to tell you about some work that I did with Preskill, I guess it's more than a year ago now, in which we think that we have some arguments really coming from information theory that that information could come out of black holes faster than you might think. So I'll explain where those arguments come from and also discuss the consequences. Now, we've seen this kind of thing many times already. The issue with black hole evaporation is that if we start off with a pure state and the black hole starts to evaporate away, eventually, eternal or long-lived remnants aside, what we expect would happen is that we're left with lots of radiation. And Hawking's semi-classical calculation suggests that radiation is thermal and therefore mixed. And so Hawking's question was, is the final state of the black hole mixed or pure? Of course, we can ask more detailed questions than that. We could ask, given some particular little packet of information that we lost inside the black hole, does that particular packet come out ever? In a more detailed way, does it come out at a particular time? Now, the question about whether a particular packet goes into a black hole or not itself suggests some other questions. And so, of course, if the answer to the question of whether or not the information comes out again is no, then as Jonathan was telling us, then, well, obviously unitary fails. But as Jonathan was telling us, there are consequences even if the information does come out. Because you can make what's called a nice slice argument that you'll end up with copies of the information existing simultaneously inside and outside the black hole, potentially. And of course, there's Dolly the Pig. We're all aware of the issues with cloning, and this would suggest a potential issue with information coming out of the black hole for unitarity.
Right? I think she's actually a sheep.
I call her a pig.
See how badly the clone
has it? That's low fidelity cloning.
So is that still a problem if it's not accessible? I mean, no single term.
Okay, so that's exactly the question that I want to get to. Now, what could be going on here? So this observation, one possible resolution to the observation was proposed by Susskind and collaborators back in the early 1990s, called the black hole complementarity principle. And it was essentially the assertion that we were making a mistake in identifying two separate copies of the quantum state inside and outside the black hole, that we should be thinking of those descriptions as dual or complementary to each other in the same way that position momentum might be complementary. And so the Hilbert space would only actually contain one copy of the state. These days, there are actual microscopic, or at least candidate microscopic realizations of such a resolution of the paradox. But back in the day, all you could really do is say, all right, well, if we accept this black hole complementarity principle as a way of resolving this cloning issue, then at the very least, that imposes some consistency constraints on the physics. And in particular, this cloning should be fictitious. And there shouldn't be an experiment that we can actually design using, say, sub-Planckian scale physics that would allow us to verify that the cloning had in fact occurred. So let's actually try to construct such an experiment and then analyze it and use the fact that it shouldn't work as some kind of consistency check. So here we have a Schwarzschild black hole in Kruskal coordinates, and so the horizon. The horizon is parallel to the V equals zero line. Here's the U equals zero line. And ingoing light rays are parallel to U. Outgoing light rays are parallel to V, and the singularity is V equals one. So the situation that we're going to consider is that we have some Alice who maybe has a very sophisticated ion trap quantum computer lab or something. So she has some well-preserved quantum information, and she falls into the black hole with her quantum information. I'd like to assume now that the Hawking radiation carries that quantum information back out of the black hole again. So her collaborator, competitor, Bob, waits outside the black hole for some period of time, collecting Hawking radiation. And when he's collected enough, he dives in after Alice. And their goal is actually to try to compare notes, to perform an experiment that would verify that Bob has a copy of the quantum information that he somehow extracted from the Hawking radiation, and Alice also has a copy. Now, as you can see in the way that I've drawn this right now, Alice and Bob are not going to be able to meet, right? So what we should allow Alice to do is just fire off a message towards Bob, right? If she performs some experiment in her lab, extracts some data about this quantum state that she had, and then Bob will collect the message from her, will look at his copy, and then see, you know, verify whether they in fact clone. But here even, Alice waited too long to send off her message, right? So the message doesn't reach Bob before Bob hits the singularity. So as we can see, the longer Bob waits, the less time Alice is actually going to have to fire off her message. So here, if Alice sends off her message a little bit earlier, then it will in fact intersect Bob's trajectory before Bob hits the singularity. And you can do the geometry here, and what you find is that the proper time available to Alice to release her message, if it is in fact to reach Bob before Bob hits the singularity, has this kind of expression. So there's some constant here, and then the Schwarzschild radius appears, and the delay, how long Bob waits outside the black hole, in measured according to Schwarzschild time. And once you have that formula in hand, then you can just say, well, let's not allow Alice to send messages at sub-Planckian frequencies, right? So that the delay that she's going to have before she can send off her message. Sorry?
Can I ask what that delta T really is?
That delta T is... the amount of... so.
Well, it's Bob's delay, but I don't really... I mean,
yeah.
Bob gets to T equals infinity when he crosses the horizon, so that's not what he means. So
oh, right. So I was thinking Bob was actually waiting at a large distance from the black hole collecting Hawking radiation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And then he starts diving in.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's actually at infinity.
It's the time when he decides. It's roughly the time when he would decide to jump in.
He's sitting in a finite range.
It's on his own. It's on Bob's watch. On Bob's watch, it doesn't take for him any amount of time.
Okay. But somehow it's called Schwarzschild.
We'll just measure it according to Schwarzschild time.
Although it stops being Schwarzschild time at the moment that Bob jumps.
I'm not sure I understand the problem. My interpretation was this, that you're sitting at some large radius like 100 m,
yeah.
And it's just lets go and falls in.
Yeah.
Bob waits in time exactly delta t, lets go and falls in.
That's right.
The exact distance Bob is waiting can't be that because the house doesn't fall.
Sorry?
Delta t equals zero on their common cleft, he just lets go and falls in.
Yeah, so Alice is free falling.
His clock reached delta t, he lets go and he falls.
Okay. So so now if we require that Alice send messages with sub-Planckian frequencies, right, so then her delay is going to have to be larger than 1. I'm just using units where h bar is equal to c equal to g equal to 1 here. And so you reverse the equation, and what you find is that the experiment can only succeed if Bob's delay here scales like radius log radius for the black hole. Okay, so if you flip that around now, if we don't want the experiment to succeed, then the information retention time for the black hole, the amount of time that has to expire between Alice falling in and the information coming out, has to be at least, now again, r log r, Schwarzschild radius log Schwarzschild radius. And that's a consistency condition. I mean, there might be other ways out of, if you found that you could verify cloning this way, there might be other ways of explaining it away. But you'll be satisfied if you actually manage to, see that the information is held in for longer than this amount of time. Yeah?
Say I'm neither Alice nor Bob, I'm a theorist just write down the theory. If the theory allows cloning, but they just can't verify it, why should I care that they can't verify it? I still got to write down this theory, and this theory allows cloning, even though it can't be verified, it's still going to be a non-unitary theory.
Well, the thing is, the theory, we didn't have a theory that actually allowed for cloning. we had a hodgepodge of sort of quantum mechanical and classical theories, right, GR and quantum field theory, that when we put them together suggested that cloning would be possible. But in the actual, I mean, these days, in the actual microphysical examples that people have, like ABS-CFT, there doesn't seem to be any issue. What really does seem to be happening is that you have dual descriptions, not double descriptions.
So when you talk about the microphysical illustrations, is that what you had in mind? Or I had the impression you had in mind some quantum optics or something like
that. Oh, I had something like that in mind, but of course, I mean, I know these things at the most, those things at the most superficial level, so.
But are there other examples, more concrete examples where?
I don't know, actually, maybe we should ask the experts here.
More concrete than what?
The realized black hole complementarity.
Does it get more concrete?
Less concrete, yeah.
So, in principle, black hole complementarity, I would say, there's no example because it would have to involve a description of observables that would be appropriate to the infalling observer. And any model that we have that would describe quantum black holes in some quantum mechanical sense does not have a description for the interior of the planet. And therefore, it would be a stretch to say that it realizes black hole complementarity if it realizes the quantum mechanical description that seems to be appropriate for an outside observer. But it doesn't explain fully what an infalling observer would see. Although, according to Samir's picture, observer would already meet something different in the horizon when it reaches that radius. So I would say that's clearly the open question, because if anyone would have a real model in which the complementarity would be realized, then I think that then we could say that the information paradox have been essentially solved.
I see, I misunderstood. I thought Patrick was saying there were some other ordinary flat space physics examples where one saw something similar.
Oh. Well, you might be able to concoct strange examples, but I haven't really
thought. Part of the idea of the complementarity is that you can have complementary observables. So it might be able to make a toy model in which something real space-time theory.
So we have our consistency condition, and let's now march off and see to what extent this consistency condition is met when we try to think about this problem of the information retention time. And one of the oldest, and perhaps one of the only estimates of the information retention time comes from what I'll call the page offsets. So in the absence, again, of a dynamical theory, he just wanted to try to get a feel for how things might behave. And I guess, actually, so this idea came from Page, but it also appeared in a paper of Suskin, Florilatius, and back in the day. So on the x-axis, I want to plot something like the amount of time that's expired, but actually what I'm interested in is the number of bits that have evaporated away from the surface of the black hole. And on the y-axis, I'll plot the entanglement entropy. I'll call them in and out degrees of freedom. But what I'm really interested in, you should really think of these as perhaps horizon degrees of freedom and radiation degrees of freedom, something like that. So how might this behave as a function of this time as measured by radiated bits? What Page, Suskind et al. Thought about was to say, okay, well, in the absence of a good dynamical model, let's just assume that the state is going to be a random state, a kind of microcanonical assumption here, subject to some constraints. But that those constraints are going to lead to some, say, horizon degrees of freedom and radiation degrees of freedom, and then we'll have a random state selected in this tensor product Hilbert space. And for simplicity, let's just say the total dimension, so again, there are constraints that result in some finite dimensionality here, the total dimension is fixed to some number that I'll just call d squared. And the area of the black hole, we should think of it as the log of the dimension of this HN system. What actually happens is that you get a tent map that looks just like this, with a slope of 1 and minus 1 on both halves. Obviously, it's going to be symmetric because we're selecting random states, and the total dimension is fixed. H in and H out just gets swapped at the halfway point. And on the left-hand side, we have a situation where there are many more. The dimension of H in is much, much larger than the dimension of H out. And so a typical state, if you think about what it looks like on H out, it is an average of a great, great, great many states on H out, much larger than the dimension of H out. And so you're likely to get something essentially thermal. And so if you come up with a kind of ad hoc information measure, which is the difference between the maximum possible entropy of the state, the reduced state, the density operator on H out, and its actual, the actual entropy of the density operator on H out, then the graph looks like this. That entropy is maximal, so the information is zero for a long, long time, and then it starts climbing linearly. And the conclusion that the qualitative conclusion reached from this was that this is some kind of explanation as to why you wouldn't expect to see any hint of the information leaking out when you do any kind of perturbative calculation or a lot of other approximations. Because your calculation would have to be unbelievably accurate for an incredibly long time before you actually started seeing correlations that would indicate deviations from complete randomness. And the estimate for the information retention time that you get out of this is that the information is going to be held inside that black hole for an amount of time proportional to the black hole lifetime, right? Because you need some constant fraction of the of all the bits to escape before you ever see anything. And the black hole lifetime, I'm just talking about Schwarzschild black holes here, is the Schwarzschild radius cubed. And if we go back to our black hole consistency condition, we see that there's no problem whatsoever, right? Schwarzschild radius cubed versus, or r cubed versus r log r. If you plug in some numbers here for, say, a solar mass black hole, you're talking, again, you have to worry a bit about the constants, but you're looking at something like milliseconds versus 10 to the 70th years, right? So the black hole complementarity condition was not only safe, but kind of comically safe, right? The gap between these two timescales is really enormous. Now, another way of thinking, maybe another way of kind of getting used to or justifying this idea that you might have to wait a very long time before recovering your information is just to think of a little thought experiment where you have a bag, right? And your bag contains a whole bunch of black balls, and it contains one white ball, right? And the bag has been shaken up, and you're interested in your white ball. So you start reaching into the bag, you pull out a ball, it's black, pull out another ball, it's black, pull out a bunch of balls, and eventually you get your white ball. And of course, how long do you expect to have to wait before you actually get the white ball out of the bag? You expect to have to pick out about half the balls, right? And so if information behaves like these balls, this is some kind of justification as to why you would have to wait a very long time before seeing anything. Now, this I'm actually putting this up here, but I think it's actually a bit of a red herring, because you get a coincidence, or you again get some kind of justification as to why you might have to wait for half the bits to evaporate. But if we now think a little bit more carefully about what might happen in a classical model of black hole, we'll see that it's quite a bit different. So here I want to discuss a kind of a schematic toy model, classical model of evaporation. I don't think it's a good model for a black hole, but just a schematic model that will get us started. So here we have our black hole type situation. And let's say the black hole was originally n minus k classical bits, right? So classical model of a black hole. And we lose the message inside the black hole, which is k bits long. So we lose the message, meaning that we don't know what the message is. If we're interested in questions of information loss and gain, we have to be very clear about what we know and what we don't know. And it's fair to say that we actually know the initial state of the black hole except for our message, right? If you think about the sun, for example, we don't think there's an information loss problem in the sun. But if we didn't actually know the state of the sun before we lose our diary in the sun or something, there's no way we're ever going to reconstruct the state of the diary. So we assume we know the state of the black hole beforehand. And then afterwards, there's some number of bits that radiate, and then the black hole continues along as n minus s bits. So the total number of bits present here is n. And then there's this issue of what does it mean for the black hole to mix? And again, we don't have a detailed model of the dynamics, so let's just see what happens for the generic transformation. So we'll just average over all possible permutations, not of the bits, right? So we have n bits, and we could permute our bits. But a much stronger kind of transformation is one in which we list all 2 to the n bit strings, right? And then we permute the bit strings. That's really thoroughly mixing. So that's the, we're going to average over those transformations. And let's get a feel for what's going to happen here. So let's just look at the example, 1 bit of radiation and a 1 bit message. So our message 0 is going to get mapped to some random bit string. I've just written down a random bit string. And our message 1 is going to get mapped to a random bit string. And then 1 bit is going to radiate away. So let's just choose some bit to radiate away. It's this one right here. So our message bit 0 gets mapped to 0. Our message bit 1 gets mapped to 1. And of course, the output is independent of the input. And so we don't learn anything at all, right? That's what happens. But see, this was actually the bit that was radiated. 0 gets mapped to 0. 1 gets mapped to 1. And somebody who collects that radiation upon receiving only 1 bit will be able to, in fact, reconstruct the message, right? And there are only 4 possible functions here from input to output. And 2 of them uniquely reveal the identity of the message, and 2 of them reveal absolutely nothing, right? So you have a probability of 1/2 of actually, over possible choices of your dynamics of being able to reconstruct the message with a single bit of radiation, independent of the size of the black hole. Right, that's a very important point here, that the size of the black hole doesn't come into this argument very much. And in general, of course, if the amount of radiation that you collected is longer, in order for these two messages to not be distinguishable, the strings that would be radiated away would have to be exactly the same, so you had S bits of radiation in S positions. And the probability of that happening is 2 to the minus S. So in general, your probability of not being able to uniquely decode the message based on what you see scales like 2 to the k minus s. K is the length of the message. S is the number of bits of radiation. And again, the key point here, and this is what I'll call a mirror effect, is that the amount of time you have to wait is independent of the size of the black hole, right? It depends only on the size of the message that went in and the amount of radiation that you collected at the end. And this is nothing very, it shouldn't be very startling. This is what computer scientists call hashing, right? This, if you wanted to go write a spell check, at least when I teach undergraduate computer science courses, I teach them about hashing and I say go write a spell checker, where they use this sort of general observation to construct a data structure to look up words. But is there a question?
So we're failing to decode the message. I'm just trying to do.
Oh yeah, so here, now if I assume that I have the uniform distribution over messages, then there's the, and we select our dynamics at random, so uniformly on the permutation group, then what is the probability, given an output string, that you can't uniquely construct the message from that output string? So that will scale, be upper bounded by 2 to the k minus s. So motivated by that kind of schematic model, or at least that we've warmed up, let's try to construct a quantum version of this that will at least recover the Pajon Sostek picture. So again, we assume that we know the state of the black hole originally. So our black hole will be n minus k qubits. So qubit is just meaning a quantum system dimension 2 to the n minus k. The 2s don't matter here, right? Just arbitrary. It's just a way of counting. And it's in a known state, which I just labeled 0. And there's a message system, M, which is in some unknown state. And then there's radiation, ultimately some number of qubits that come off. And then there's some number of qubits that remain inside the black hole. And the dynamics is not going to be a permutation now, but some unitary transformation. And let's be agnostic for the moment about what that unitary transformation should be. And again, as compared to the page type description, I want to be very demanding about what it means for information to come out of the black hole. So in particular, if there's some particular state that was prepared on the message system, that what I want to be true is that there is a decoding operation that someone who collects all that radiation can perform that's independent of the state and will produce a pretty good copy of it. at the output. That's what I actually mean by the information coming in. And this, again, the important thing is that this decoding operation can depend on the transformation V, can depend on the initial state of the black hole, but can't depend on the message system in any way. Now, there's a little mathematical sleight of hand that you can perform here that actually makes this tractable. So instead of thinking about preparing particular states on the message system, it's convenient to instead postulate the existence of what I'll call a reference system. So it's of the same dimension as M, and it's, say, maximally entangled with M. So you prepare like an EPR type pair here of a pair of qubits, and you allow one half to fall inside the black hole. And sending arbitrary quantum states from the message system to the output is equivalent to establishing entanglement between N and the output, which at first glance might not seem to be any kind of simplification for you. But there's a further equivalence that then makes this much easier to deal with, which is that establishing entanglement between this reference and the radiation is equivalent to eliminating all correlation between the reference and the black hole, the post-evaporation black hole state. So if you prepare, if you manage to construct some argument, there's a product state on N and B prime, then you know essentially by the process of elimination, because no information is destroyed in quantum mechanics, that you will have established high quality entanglement between the reference and the radiation. So I'll just illustrate that. I apologize for the silly cartoon. I like to give this as a Blackboard talk, but I already gave this as a Blackboard talk at the Perimeter Institute about a year ago, and so I have to do something different. Okay, so in quantum information theory, we like to talk about what we call the Church of larger Hilbert space. And essentially, given mixed states, so say we have a mixed state rho sub x on some system x, the pure state psi sub xy on x tensor y is a purification of rho if, when we trace over the y system, we get back the density operator rho sub x. And there's this what would seem to be a little technicality about these purifications, which is in fact extremely important, which is that purifications are essentially unique. They're unique up to local unitary transformations of the purifying space. And so now let's consider this situation. Remember, N was the reference system, B prime was the post-evaporation black hole system.
So what do you mean by local unitary?
Oh, so local meaning acting, so only, acting, I could have dropped the word local, acting only on the purifying space, yeah, but not on the X, here would act on the Y system, but not the M system, yeah. So suppose now that we have one of these tensor product states on the reference and the post-evaporation black hole system. Okay, so they visit the Church of larger Hilbert space, blah, 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 blah. What we have, I'm using these green lines to somehow illustrate potential quantum mechanical correlation. We have a pure quantum state of the reference, post-black hole, and evaporation products, right? So there are three pieces to this system. And let's just arbitrarily decompose the radiation products into an R1 and an R2, okay? So let's just arbitrarily decompose them like that. So there could be correlations of any type in the system, say between R1 and R2, or R1 and N, R1 and B prime, whatever, right? There can be correlations all over. The one thing that we do know is that there are no correlations between N and B prime. So there's no green line there. Now, purifications are essentially unique in the sense that they're unique up to some local some unitary transformation of the purifying space. So let's just think of a different purification of rho n tensor sigma b prime, right? Another way to purify is to first purify the reference system with this state phi, right, up to R1, and then to purify the black hole up to R2. And because we have a product state, we can do that, right? That is a valid purification. But if we can transform one purification to another by unitary transformation, and there is this use of R acting on the radiation degrees of freedom, that will relate the state that we're actually given to this one right here, right? We can do that if we actually had control of the radiation. And what we'd be left with is, in fact, a tensor product system. And this one, the state phi, is precisely the state that we would be interested in, It's the state in which there is high quality entanglement between the reference and a subsystem of the radiation. Right? So this theorem about uniqueness is what tells us that there will exist a decoding procedure for Bob. Given that little lemma theorem, we can just ignore the decoding procedure for Bob completely and study the question of how we can establish that there's a tensor product state between B prime and N. Okay, so here's our little experiment. This is supposed to be a violent system, maybe a black hole, I suppose. So Alice appears, and she prepares the system N and M in an entangled state, and she drops the M system into the black hole. And of course, the question that we were interested in is how long until the entanglement escapes. It's equivalent to how long until the black hole forgets about N. So the black hole is radiating away, and at some time in the future, the correlation disappears. As when we were talking about the classical model, we don't, at least I don't know how to calculate what the dynamics is there. And so let's just be ignorant about it. Let's just see what happens generically. And so if we average over Haar measure unitaries acting on the black hole system, then we can ask, for a given amount of evaporation products, how close is the actual density operator on that system to the tensor product density operator that you get by looking at the tensor product of the marginals? And this is a calculation that you can do, and it's not actually even a very delicate one. So you get this answer for Haar measure V. You get essentially the same answer if you choose your other, whatever other favorite matrix ensemble you want. Circular symplectic, circular orthogonal. There are lots of finite subgroups of the unitary group that give you the same answer. So this isn't a very delicate calculation.
So effectively, a black hole is doing a measurement of M.
It's not doing a measurement.
In some sense, it's doing in the sense that it projected onto a diagonal.
So your black hole is forgetting about M.
Yeah, it's forgetting about it, but.
Yeah, so it's, I see what you mean. So you're saying it's sort of projecting onto a state which is independent of M. I think you can say that. I see it. That by averaging over the unitary group, it's like some kind of projection. That's what you're thinking. So this is the expression that you get. And one way of reading it is that in order to get good decoupling between N and B prime, right, between the reference system and the post-evaporation black hole, you need the number of bits evaporated to be larger than N plus K over 2, meaning you have to have gone past the halfway point, right? And you have to go a little bit past the halfway point depending on how long the message is that you want to recover. And so this is really just the page conclusion all over again. Right, it's exactly what we already knew. Although there's something kind of interesting about this, right? Which is that immediately ever after having crossed the halfway point, and then you wait this little tiny little bit of extra time based on how big the message is, then you recover your message exactly, right? Or not exactly, but to high fidelity. And it doesn't matter which message what message you created. You could have even had lots of people dropping messages into the black hole. In some sense, they could all, any one of them could have recovered their message immediately after getting to the halfway point. And so I'll leave it to you to think about why that's not actually a violation of cloning. That's what happens. All right, so here's a slight variation on that experiment. Okay, so here we have our black hole radiating away, radiate, and then along comes Alice, right? And Alice drops her message system into the black hole. So it's almost the same experiment as before. Of course, there goes the correlation. Except that we sort of start the whole process on the downslope of that page graph, right? So we have a very old black hole that Alice approaches and drops her information into. And the question is, does this modify the conclusions in any way? The way that we can model this in terms of our little diagram is that instead of saying that the initial state of the black hole is pure in some known state, we say that the initial state of the black hole is highly entangled with some early radiation, right? So that's what this kind of diagram indicates, that there was some interaction in the past. Some of it is still in the black hole. The rest of it, we call it the system E, early radiation. And if we wait long enough, then the black hole, whatever the contents are, there should be relatively few bits relative to the amount of radiation that came out in the past. And those bits that are left behind should be very, very, very highly entangled with the radiation that went out. And what we'll do then is, while Alice only arrived on the scene late, we'll imagine that there was a Bob who collected all that early radiation. Right? So he has access to that, and he'll also have access to the radiation that comes off the black hole later. And he'll be able to construct his decoding operation using all these degrees of freedom. Well, you can just do the calculation again. And lo and behold, what actually comes out of it, there's no longer any independence, right? So in particular, in order to get good decoupling, all that needs to be true is that the number of bits of radiation, S, has to be larger than the size of the message that you dropped in. And this is what we called the mirror effect before when we were looking at the classical system. That the amount of radiation you have to collect is independent of how big that black hole is. Of course, Bob had to sit around for a long time beforehand collecting lots of radiation. And the amount he had to collect did depend on the amount on the size of the black hole. But the number of bits that you have to collect after Alice dropped her information in is independent of the size. Now, if you want to develop some intuition as to why it should be so much faster in this circumstance, we're trying to produce a product state on N and B prime. And the product state we're actually going to be trying to make is the maximally mixed state, the sort of thermal state. And the black hole starts off essentially thermal, and the only thing that messes it up is this piece that Alice dropped in, right? But the piece that Alice dropped in is very, very little, and so you don't require a lot of, there's not a lot of work to be done to recover that maximally mixed state after Alice has dropped her information in. You just have to sort of get rid of a very little bit of correlation that depends on how big the message was, and then you're done. Whereas in the original picture, the black hole started off in a pure state, and you sort of have a lot of noise to inject into the black hole before you manage to produce something that's highly mixed.
The decoding function obviously depends on V, but does it also depend on when Alice drops her information in? I mean, if she drops it in after 4 bits versus after 5 bits came out.
Yes. In general, it will.
You would also have to know to pretty good precision.
Oh, you have to know all kinds of things to extraordinary precision.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, even knowing the decoding function given V is obviously.
Right. Yeah.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is how universal the decoding function is.
So I see. And there's an interesting asymmetry here, which is that I almost actually think of the dynamics of the black hole as an encoding function. There's an irony, which is that this big mixing function, you would think that's sort of what smears out the information, makes it very inaccessible for you. But the flip side of that is that is precisely what makes it robust to the noise.
And it correlates with.
Because it correlates with everything. So that's a very universal property. It's very generic. But once you've fixed your V, the decoding transformation, I might even guess that it's unique. I'm not sure about that, but unless there's... Well, maybe not quite unique. Like, there's some sort of degeneracy because you have a whole subspace here that you're trying to transmit, but I don't think you have a lot of freedom in your choice of decoding. You might be able to design more, like in information theory, this is something that we worry about, as designing codes that are robust to many different channels at the same time. And if you have the freedom to construct arbitrary decodings, or encodings, you can do that. But the difficulty here is that we don't have control over it, our encoding. Our encoding is the black hole dynamics. And so, I think it might, you might be in a pretty rough shape with respect to that decoding.
If you would know the theory of everything, and you would know the initial state of the black hole, then you could do it,
in principle, yeah.
I'm actually confused. I don't even understand why it has anything to do with the microscopic physics now.
No, because the decoding map is non-universal, but it goes into the uniqueness theorem, but the uniqueness up to unitary transformations. But the unitary transformation will be part of the decoding map.
Yeah.
But I'm confused because now the Planck length doesn't enter into anything. Because, in other words, the number of bits you need doesn't depend at all on the plan.
Oh, it's going to appear.
The number of steps that you can do in a certain amount of time, I think, right?
Yeah, so so there's small print, which I'm about to...
Okay.
Yeah. So here's a small print, right? That we've assumed that integrating over random unitary transformations gives us a good approximation of what might actually happen in practice. And that's not at all justified, I don't think, right? That roughly speaking, this is an assumption of some kind of instantaneous thermalization, right? And a very thermalization in a very, very strong sense, that somehow you've managed to map it. You know, every state in phase space is equally likely to map anywhere else, right? That's sort of what we're the kind of situation that is represented by integrating over a random unitary transformation. So that doesn't happen, right? The amount of time it takes to thermalize certainly will depend on the size of the black hole. And so now we have to actually ask the question. We have to ask the question, how long is it going to take to thermalize? But we've made some progress in that we've now shifted our attention from the lifetime of the black hole to the thermalization time when it comes to trying to actually identify the correct time scale for information retention.
Right. We know how fast you can get information out has to do with you have to wait for it to get more scrambled or to correlate with everything until you can get it out. Whereas, I mean, you might have thought if you could just grab the information out pretty quick before it thermalized.
Well, that's also true, right? Like, if you could grab the information before it thermalized from a particular, you know, if it's localized in some location, and you're really lucky that there's some Hawking radiation that for some reason only interacted with those local bits and then came out, then you'd be able to recover that information. But it seems unlikely that's how the dynamics work. All right, so what do we know about thermalization time of a Schwarzschild black hole? Well, we know that there are these quasi-normal modes, and they ring down. They have some characteristic time, which is something like the Schwarzschild radius. There's this other interesting calculation that you can do where you place a droplet of charge on the stretched horizon, so one Planck length above the event horizon, and you ask, how long does it take for that charge to spread over the whole surface? And what you get now is not just RS, but RS log RS. So there's an appearance of that log term. And then you might try to say, okay, well, what kind of thing might we see in ABS-CFT? So again, I'm talking about a Schwarzschild black hole, but in ABS-CFT, you have thermalization time for your conformal field theory.
When you talk about thermalization time, you actually talk about the mixing of a few bits in this nearly thermal.
Yes.
Rather than in this earlier situation that you considered where the black hole itself would initially be in some more specialized state.
Yeah, no, most definitely, right? And so you get something like 1 over the Hawking temperature, which if we were to translate back to the Schwarzschild picture, we'd be saying something again like RS. But that condition is much weaker than what we're actually interested in, right? That this kind of thermalization, as you say, is perturbing from equilibrium state and then just looking at maybe a two-point correlation function and asking how long it takes to recover its equilibrium value. Whereas what we're interested in is taking very large subsets of all of the degrees of freedom and asking, does that large subset of all the degrees of freedom look thermal? Where the subset is some constant fraction of all of the degrees of freedom. And that's obviously much more stringent. So these will be lower bounds on what I would call, say, the scrambling time or something like that. But they're certainly not upper bounds, right? There's some kind of relaxation processes, and we're interested in essentially all relaxation processes. So you may even ask the question at this point. I mean, there's some suggestion that maybe R log R is the right answer, but it's very tentative. You might even ask, is it even possible to mix a system in R log R time in such a way that we actually get the answer that we're looking for. It turns out that it is, at least in principle. So first off, I was integrating over random unitary transformations, how random. And an elementary observation is that that is a very, very bad model of any physical system. And the reason is that there are just too many, like if you have n qubits, and you want to sort of place some reason, you want to sample from the Haar measure, so you place some, you discretize the unitary group, the number of points that you're going to need is going to be doubly exponential in n, right? It's a huge number of points. But now imagine you have some device, right, such that at every time step, maybe you flip five switches or something, and you let it run for, you know, k time steps. Then the number of unitaries you manage to make that way is 5 to the k, right? It's singly exponential in the number of steps you take. And so there's no way that you can ever sample uniformly from the unitary group for a large system. And so anyone who does, who uses random matrices and says that random matrices are good models of the physical system, the only reason it's a good model potentially is that they're only looking at very specific test functions. Okay, so we can't just say that random unitary transformations are good, but we are looking at a very particular test function, right? We're just interested in how close we are to being that product state according to some particular norm. And it turns out that it's enough to recover, to do a calculation where we only look at degree 4 polynomials in the matrix entries of that unitary transformation, right? We're not interested in arbitrarily high moments. We're just doing some finite moments. And quantum information people, for reasons of their own, figured out ways to do this, and they call them unitary two designs. And if you only want to get approximately epsilon approximate unitary two designs, so the people involved were actually here at Waterloo, Dankert, Cleve, Emerson, and Levine. Levine, I think, was actually Perimeter. And what they showed is that if you have n qubits and you want to recover, say, that expression that that I was using, that distance to the product state, then you can do it with the dynamics that looks like this. You have n qubits, time increases vertically. So you take, at any given time step, you take pairs, okay? And you can interact many pairs at the same time. And you apply some kind of finite strength interaction. And then you can ask, well, how long do you have to run that in order to get the right answer? It turns out you only have to run it log n time steps. So not very long at all, this kind of process. And if we now want to translate this back, we could just say, well, what's an appropriate, if we want to think about the black hole, what's an appropriate time step? So n, remember, is the size of the black hole, so it's like the area. And of course, the Schwarzschild radius goes like, or rather the area goes like the Schwarzschild radius squared. So what is a time step? Let's say, I'm going to do this in two different ways, but let's say that it's one Planck time and one proper Planck length above the horizon. So we, again, as Herman was saying, we don't really know at all what the dynamics are there, but it could be the case, or it's not completely unlikely the dynamics is quite non-local there. And so this type of picture that I've drawn where we interact qubits that are arbitrarily far apart might not be completely unreasonable. So then what you find is that the thermalization time, which is your information retention time, goes like the log of n, which is the log of the area, log rs. Now, we have to translate this back to Schwarzschild observer time. And then, so there's a redshift from this observer to the Schwarzschild observer and that's proportional to rs. And so we get an estimate of the information retention time this way of rs log rs, which, in case you've forgotten, is exactly the same scaling that we had from the black hole complementarity consistency condition. And so things now, if you believe this, of course, this is obviously the much more speculative half of the talk, it looks like black hole complementarity is safe, but safe on a knife edge, right? Not safe by miles like it was with the original page offsets, but sort of just safe.
Are you assuming you could have sort of plaquettes on opposite ends of the black hole, and you'd be able to couple them in one black?
In that picture, I am. Which is so that's not actually how we originally wrote the paper. This version was actually suggested by Lenny Susskind. We weren't courageous enough to suggest that there might be non-local dynamics there, although I guess Samir's picture suggest that that, that you might be getting something like that. But how about I'll give you version two, which might be more to your liking.
Very briefly, coming back to the statement of the previous transparency assessment. So the thermalization, the log n, refers to thermalization of a few qubits in a large ensemble. Or thermalization of the whole thing.
Thermalization of the whole thing. It's surprisingly strong. So the kind of expression that you need to look at is one like this, right? So you take the reference system and everything left inside the black hole, and you ask, this density operator here is basically thermal, or it's maximally, say it's maximally mixed on N and D prime. So you're asking, is this density operator as entropic as it could possibly be? So it's really for a very large number of degrees of freedom.
There is another somewhat confused here. Because you wanted to go to this halfway point, a fast halfway point, to get the fast information retrieval. why was it again that in the earlier case that it took longer when you didn't start with the thermal?
Well, one way to think about it is the black hole starts off at a pure state. And then you can ask, how much can the entropy of what's left behind increase for every bit that gets lost? And the answer is just one bit, right? That when you lose a bit, you can establish one EPR pair of entanglement, right? Which means that the local density operator acquires one bit of noise. So if you started off pure, for every bit that you emit, your entropy can go up by at most one. So your entropy is going up by one, and also your system is shrinking at the same time. So you kind of you're racing towards a destination from two directions, but you need them to meet, right? The entropy of the system has to be ultimately the same as the size of the system. So that's why you have to get halfway.
Sorry, but you're talking about two entropies. I guess it's the entanglement entropy between the radiation and the black hole. Obviously, that can only increase,
exactly.
As you said.
Yeah.
But the internal entropy of the black hole can be maximal very little. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. So the internal entropy, I'm not even really thinking about it. That it's only the entanglement entropy that's relevant for this calculation.
But you have this notion of thermalization of the internal.
So when I say thermalization, I really should say
mixing.
That what I'm interested in is whether or not the reduced density operator, when I trace over the degrees of freedom of the radiation, gives me something which is maximally entropic. So is the entanglement entropy from the from D prime and N as a collective system to R as large as it could possibibe?
But I guess because one question that I'm interested in also is that if I would start out, maybe I should ask this question at the end, but start out with say, I want to make it a black hole by two pure states, whatever, two particles colliding with some very high energy. Okay. So I start out with a black hole that is in a pure state. Mm-hmm. Kind of. How long would it need to take for it to reach an entropy that would be sort of maximal corresponding to
its thermodynamic entropy?
Would that also go like log of n?
I don't think so.
I mean, if it's starting out per se, the basic history of every bit of entropy, you know, one over the area. Bits away.
So before it can actually reach.
Before it can reach its actual
as an entanglement state.
That's right.
Yes. But maybe you're going to talk about this.
Do you want to do some kind of force thing?
My confusion is into something. It's a different kind of question than the one that you're asking.
Yeah.
But I'm just wondering if this kind of same kind of logic could be sort of
Yeah, it might be. I mean, I have to admit that I'm a little bit confused about, I have to be very, very specific about what this entropy means, I think, before I can give an estimate of how it will change. Okay, so back through this again.
But again, when you mean determinization here, this thing is means the.
Yeah, I mean, I use the word thermalization, but I should use something that it sounds tougher, right? So I just use the word scrambling because I think that's what that's what's going to be used later. So what I mean is the amount of time required in order to satisfy our condition, which is this very strong mixing condition.
Actually, weren't you allowing kind of arbitrary pairwise unitaries? Why aren't I just, it's a small set, just say I just got one big unitary, and therefore scrambling time is just arbitrary. Why is that?
Well, but you can't make an arbitrary large unitary.
Why couldn't quantum gravity be?
Well, quantum gravity might be different.
Once I'm allowing this, it doesn't seem a big step to just allow one big unitary.
Yeah, although it actually goes the other way around, you want to be somewhat conservative with the type of contraction. This is already sort of non-conservative thing.
Well, exactly. I guess what I'm saying is once you allow a little bit, why is it stopping you from allowing a lot? No, once you're allowing arbitrary pairwise things, why not just say, well, it could just be one?
Well, because I think that we all believe there's some dynamics there, which is generated by, there's some Hamiltonian in which it doesn't just, it's not just some great big random matrix. So I'll just get on to the other version of this, which is actually the version that we had in our paper to begin with. And it's kind of remarkable that it gets us to the same point. So now let's say again, what is the time step? Well, suppose you're an observer far away, and you're looking at this black hole, and you have some description of the black hole. And you might say, well, one Planck unit of my time, right? So one Planck unit of Schwarzschild time. So now you're thinking of an observer who's far away from the black hole. And now I would think it's probably pretty unreasonable to suspect that the reason that observer is going to see large-scale violations of locality. So now you want his gates to actually be local with respect to some two-dimensional geometry of the horizon. And then you can use the same construction as Dankert et al. From the previous slide, but because you're constrained to only interact things locally, there's a slowdown. Right, which is that if you have two qubits that were far away from each other, they need to interact, and you have to move one of them close to the other one before they actually do the job. Right, so there's a slowdown, which is the light crossing time, which is Rs. Right, so Rs was the redshift before, but now it's actually the light crossing time for the black hole. But it all comes to the same point, which is that the thermalization time is Rs log area, so Rs log Rs again. And so you may prefer this version. again, it's all pretty hand-wavy, so I don't think either one is obviously more correct than the other. But you again get the sort of the knife edge condition for black hole complementarity consistency.
Anybody imagine that I have local, I guess it's also an R squared log R that I also forget, but I imagine that it was kind of locally interacting plus the dark direction. Was it just
Well, there's no redshift anymore because I'm saying it's one Planck time for a Schwarzschild observer, right? So,
but if you mixed up version one and version two,
if you mixed up version one and version two, then you could get an R squared up there, which may actually be the appropriate thing to do.
So it would slow it down, not.
It would slow it down. It would still be less than R cubed, right? It'd still be significantly less than the black hole lifetime, but you now no longer actually sort of be right on the knife edge. And I shouldn't rule it out, categorically, since this is all pretty speculative.
What would be an assumption you could make about the unitary transformation which would violate the complementarity bound?
The kind of thing that Jonathan was suggesting.
Completely random.
So completely random is very strong, though. There are finite subgroups of the unitary group. This one, it sounds a little bit contrived, but we use it a lot in quantum information theory. So if you take tensor products of the Pauli operators, right, so that generates a group. So you take the normalizer of that group in the unitaries. It's a bit of a weird thing, but it's a finite group. And it's for example, the group that's good enough for doing quantum error correction. So when people talk about building a quantum computer, this quantum error correction, the operations required are in that group. And it's called the Clifford group. And if you average over the Clifford group, then you actually get exactly what's necessary here. So if for some reason those operations were natural, I don't think they are. That's a very combinatorial thing. It would happen instantaneously. I think actually the law that scaling is somewhat robust. I mean, you can imagine something a little bit more natural, like just random interactions that are local and finite strength. And then what you find is you again get this r log r type behavior.
So what you really need is that they're not the kind of long range interactions.
Well, they could be long range. What you need is that they're not many body. Actually, that's what you need.
Oh, that's long range.
Oh, okay. Well,
they
could
be
all local.
Local.
But they're not going to be. You want an interaction that in Hamiltonian that simultaneously involve a number of sites, which is growing with the black hole. Actually, you can prove a little theorem of that type. That provided that such a condition holds, and some other assumptions on Hamiltonian, that you will always get this log factor for longer. So just to put all this
in. This provides some sort of test if someone proposes a particular model of black hole dynamics. Their thermalization shouldn't be any faster than this r log.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you could try to turn it around. I think actually that's what Lenny and SP1 do. So yeah, I just wanted to put this in context, in that this connects with some pretty old results in quantum information theory, in particular result that in every different field you have your favorite questions. And in information theory, we tend to ask what are called capacity questions, which may not seem like they're of interest to you, but it's the capacity question that's actually, there's a capacity question lurking underneath what we discuss here, what we've been discussing. So the post-evaporation black hole system is for all intents and purposes unavailable to us, right? So we have some kind of quantum mechanical noisy channel from our message to radiation, right? And what does that channel do? Well, it erases some of our qubits, right? Or it just takes them away from us. We know which ones they are, but says, okay, you don't have access to them anymore. And in information theory, we call that an erasure channel. And roughly speaking, we have an erasure probability here corresponding to the fraction of the system that was eliminated, right? So the fraction of the system that was eliminated is 1 minus the number of qubits that you get out over the total number of qubits in the black hole. So this thing that we're talking about is essentially an erasure channel. And back in the 1990s, I guess what I should have here is Bennett, Shor, Thapliyal, and Smollett in 1999, and also Bennett, DiVincenzo, and Smollett in 1997, they looked at how well you could transmit quantum information through erasure channels. And in particular, if your goal is just to try to get quantum states through, here I have the transmission probability. What they found is that you can't get any quantum states through until the fraction of transmitted qubits is at least a half. And this is exactly what Page found also. Right, essentially another language, that if you are trying to transmit quantum states through an erasure channel, you get nothing until your probability of getting something, getting a qubit through is, or until the fractions of qubits that come through is more than a half. But what they also found, the Page didn't find, is that if you supplement your channel with some entanglement from the sender to the receiver, then the capacity graph looks different, and in fact, the capacity is non-zero for all erasure probabilities. And that's exactly what we've been seeing today, that we have some entanglement established essentially between the black hole and the receiver, Bob, and that entanglement makes it possible to recover quantum information dropped into the black hole for any erasure probability, right? So so Bob starts being able to recover quantum information immediately after stuff starts coming out of the black hole. And so these things have been known for a long time in some form, and we're sort of just putting a different spin on them. So that's what I wanted to tell you. The one thing that I want to emphasize is that there are two parts to this argument. And the first part, I think, is fairly robust, right? This shift of emphasis from the black hole lifetime to some kind of black hole scrambling time, super thermalization time, as being the relevant time scale for information retention. And then the second half is much less robust, because the second half, without any real dynamical model, I wanted to come up with some estimates of what that super scrambling time might actually be. But the bottom line is that assuming that information does come out of a black hole, which is a big assumption, not one held by everybody here, there are circumstances in which that information probably comes up out faster, significantly faster than we previously thought. So there are other things that could be done. You know, you could ask this question in other geometries, and it might work out the same way, it might work out differently. Something that I've ignored all the way through, which is perhaps not completely ignorable, is the amount of time that it would take Bob, this decoder, to actually decode the quantum information, right? I've been assuming that Bob can perform his transformation instantaneously. But we know from studying classical error correcting codes that, say, decoding a random, what's called a linear error correcting code, is an NP-hard problem. So we don't expect to be able to do it in polynomial time. We expect it takes exponential time. And this is a random quantum error correcting code with no structure whatsoever, as far as we can tell. So most likely, Bob would take a colossal, colossal amount of time. Even if he could build his apparatus, the amount of time it would take his apparatus to run would probably be exponential or worse in the size of the black hole. So there's a hidden time scale there. But
here's the issue of how big an apparatus can be, right? I mean, since you're not inside the black hole, if he has a lot of bits and does a lot of parallel processing, can't he cut the time down to as small as he wants?
He might create a black hole. And
yeah. Well, it's not clear that these problems would be parallelizable. So it's possible. It's possible.
So not every problem can be solved in an arbitrary short time by making a big enough computer. Is that right?
So, yeah. Although the thing is, again, I think a lot of people would be pretty disappointed if you had to resort to computational complexity arguments to sort of preserve the validity of black hole complementarity, right? That would be kind of disturbing, because it would mean that you're unlikely to be able to see black hole complementarity working in practice in any reasonable theory, because it's only protected by extremely, you know, extremely subtle metamathematical arguments. So I think it's somewhat reassuring that we don't need to worry too much about Bob's decoding complexity, but we might have had to. Yeah.
Why do we need to worry at all? Because, even if he doesn't decode it, he's still got a clone sitting there, and maybe it may have some random unitary applied to the clone. I mean, basically, has the original state plus a clone which has an arbitrary unitary, and that's just not possible either. So you've already kind of, he would already, I mean, he might not be able to. It should be just as disturbing, isn't it?
Well, I think the idea, at least, maybe it's less disturbing, but I wanted to take a kind of operational approach, right? Where we wanted to see whether Alice and Bob could perform an experiment in which they detect cloning. And if Bob can, if there's no measurement that Bob can do in a reasonable amount of time that would give results different, incompatible with quantum mechanics, right? So incompatible with linearity of quantum mechanics, then I'd say it's not as disturbing a violation. Or at least you haven't ruled out a quantum mechanical description of what's going on.
I suppose he doesn't need to actually decode this thing because he's got two copies. He just needs to show that one's a unitary description.
So there's certainly other things that might be possible, but I think that it's going to be unavoidable that he somehow has to concentrate this information into a much smaller system, right? He has a great, great big system, and he has to actually somehow get it down. So there are other directions that you could study. This construction of Dankert et al. Is something very kind of computer science-y and specific, right? It's just a proof of concept that you can design a system that will mix scramble on the time scale that we're interested in. But it's not anything that would ever happen by chance in nature. So you can try to study things that are a little bit more plausible, and baby steps towards that would be studying random quantum circuits, or studying, with NEMA I've been doing this, studying Hamiltonians, stochastically varying Hamiltonians, and seeing what kind of time scale you get for convergence of those. And ultimately, you'd like to go all the way to matrix models or something more that really we actually think has a chance of describing a real black hole out there, and that kind of segues into Yasuhiro's talk for tomorrow. So I think there are lots of questions, and they're all along the lines of trying to make this what is a very schematic argument right now into something more solid that connects to connects to real physics. The last result I should mention with Matt Hastings is that we do have some kind of bound on what can be done with a reasonable Hamiltonian. I showed you that it was possible to mix in a time log n for the non-local Hamiltonian. We can essentially prove for a wide class of Hamiltonians that you can never do it faster than that. So we're making a little bit of progress. That's it. More questions?
So you spoke of operational questions. So do you have any idea in practice, I mean, this is all to do with failures of unitarity or non-failures of unitarity. How good are there any good bounds from any kind of experiment on how unitary we know quantum mechanics is? We know, let's say, nature is in situations where the theory tells us that it is unitary.
Well, I'm certainly not an expert on this. I mean, any kind of quantum computing experiment is some kind of test of the unitarity of quantum mechanics. And to the extent that people have built, 10-qubit systems and actually manipulated them.
Is that the status right now, 10 qubits? Is that wrong?
10 qubits that aren't fully controllable. Manny Kanil, who's played a big role in the history of quantum computing, up until a couple of years ago, he liked to give us, get people riled up by giving a talk saying that no one has built even a single qubit, according to his specifications. So there are those kinds of experiments. And then there are all kinds of indirect experiments, I guess, right, where you make predictions that are in which the unitarity of quantum mechanics is kind of operating in the background.
You can flip a coin a million times and add up the number of heads plus the number of tails. If it comes out to less than a million, that's a violation of
humanity. Well, that's probability question. That's a much weaker.
It's sort of more to.
The CP maps that satisfy that are very
nice. There's people in this that are trying to, since you talked about a bit about Roger Penrose's stuff, they're trying to do experiments that prove that. Basically, satellite based experiments.
Like testing for your spontaneous collapse models?
Well, not necessarily that, but just looking at your decoherence times. I don't think that it's a proposal.
But these measurements of three spin and pen, isn't that the GAC, the Greenhorn Schrodinger? Isn't that sort of a test?
Well, it's, I don't know. It's a test of something.
I think it's a test of a linear structure.
Testing the linear structure, and it's testing things are squares of amplitudes. But
yeah. Actually, so an important point about this.
So the IQC, they're doing tests also, so called test of the Born square, whether probabilities really are squares of amplitudes.
So unitarity isn't actually crucial in this thing. This existence of the decoding operation for Bob, that really just depends on the vector space structure. Now, whether or not Bob could actually perform the operation he needs to perform, right? If there's some kind of rapid, spontaneous decoherence that happens, then he won't be able to do it. But with respect to what happens inside the black hole, it doesn't actually really matter that much that it's unitary. In the sense that the stuff that remains stuck inside the black hole remains, it injects tons of noise but remains stuck there. So you could have a system that's generating lots of noise, and you'd still actually manage to get your quantum information out, but there'd be a floor. At some point, you'd run out of the ability to send quantum information through the thing.
Can I ask you as well, this works as well, right? If I have a black hole sharing random correlations with that person outside, the same argument goes through exactly this complete classical system.
Yeah, I mean, the only difference is that there isn't this waiting time at the beginning, which is a very quantum mechanical effect.
Well, do I need to, I mean, if I form my black hole by just throwing in half, I just form my black hole by taking half of a maximum entangled state, form my black hole with the other half, then right away I get the information out of this form.
Yes.
Wasting time at all.
Yeah.
So what you're saying is that this fact that the information comes out again has nothing to do with whether or not the internal dynamics of the black hole is unitary, but more what to do with the randomness.
Well, it's not that it has nothing to do with it. I mean, you can imagine dynamics that just take the interior of the black hole and send it to...
No, but anyway, but that would have certain violations of unitarity in the black hole without violating anything.
Yeah, that would actually be okay.
Did I understand you saying that in this optimistic scenario, it's r log r time to get the information back up as you send in the second half of the life of the black hole? So that, I mean, that sounds amazingly short, right? Because the time to emit one quantum of
quantum
radiation is r.
Yeah.
Log r is just, well.
Log R is not very big.
It's not very big.
I mean, there's
so
some factor, of course, on the whole thing. Yeah, no, it's not much longer than it's almost the first quantum to come out.
Yeah, so the most you could seem to recover one zero or something.
The three factors.
Sorry, I should have said, of course,
it's that multiplied by the number that.
That multiplied by the size of the message you wanted to recover. No, it's not. Sorry, it's that. Plus k times r, where k is like so you need to mix, and then once it's mixed, you have to collect your number of quantum.
So there's like one extra quantum.
Yeah.
And what about this picture you had on the board, where you had all these vertical lines, and then you were drawing lines between them to scramble them? It's very similar to the picture we actually used for this D1D5 system. We had talked a little bit about this yesterday. We actually draw exactly these lines like this for the strings. Mm-hmm. And then because they're at the same point, the interaction, this so-called orbifold model of the CFT, that any two strings can twist around, and any data on one string can get split between those two. And all the interactions happen at the same time. That's called the twist operator, which takes any two strings and
twists them.
Right, the conjugation class of the group and the deformation operator is sigma 1, 2. So you have exactly these n lines. N is the number of, it's actually n1 times n5, that's just a capital N number of things. And the interaction operator just switches in a binary way. And then any data you have, they can all operate simultaneously because you have sigma ij summed over I, comma j is the interaction at any time. You just summarize with that.
Oh, okay, we should definitely talk about this. It might be
actually. It's so much like what we draw in some completely different context. I'll mention that.
The human D-current system does come from a matrix, not quantum mechanics, but quantum.
It's a quantum point.
So.
Which is the interaction is also very similar, just
right.
Binary interaction, which is pairs of lines.
But in the structure matrix quantum mechanics, it's always like, isn't the structure matrix quantum mechanics?
The matrix string theory, that's the vertex. It's the string vertex that's doing the splitting.
Is it actually a twisting operation?
Yes.
So, does it represent the break group somehow? Or is this...
It's just a
it connects and
reconnects.
So, Z2 twist, it takes the two strands and connects this strand to this and this to this. So, they actually interchange. But in that process, there's a vertex there, so any excitation on this gets split into excitation on both strands. So, if the energy is only one, it cannot share on both.
More questions?
Thank the speaker again.